Hello everyone, my name is Ryan and you are listening to the Vegan Report. Today I want to show you what the world of politics looks like at its best, when it is embodied by hopeful, passionate and inspiring leaders who dare to dream of a more compassionate world. A rare kind of politics, light years away from the small world of calculating, cynical, and power-hungry politicians. Today, we are talking to the candidates of the Animal Protection Party of Canada, who share with us tales of their uphill battle against a system that keeps them locked outside the centers of power. Their names are Liz White, Edward Fraser, Deborah Wall, Irene Kaye, and Mike Beach. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. So happy to see you all. Let me start with this icebreaker question. Can you please state your name and also talk about your vegan or animal rights hero?
Yeah, so I can start. My name is Mike Peach. I'm from St. John's, Newfoundland. And I've been vegan and animal liberation activist for about 10 years now. It's hard to say pick one specific activist for as a hero, but there's a couple I like. I like Melanie Joy. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's the one who came up with the term carnism to explain the belief system that most people in society get indoctrinated into from a young age that makes them prejudiced against certain species of animals considered food. So she explains how it's a learned behavior and all the parallels with other systematic forms of oppression and discrimination. She has a really good TED Talk that I like. It's usually the first thing that I recommend people watch when I do street outreach. So yeah, that's, and then there's a couple other common ones that most people like. I like Gary Yourofsky. There's Joey Carbstrong and Earthling Ed. I like Earthling Ed too. I want to do more of the, try to figure out how to set up where they do the tables and then they just sit down and invite people to come chat with them. I think that's a good form of street outreach too.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mike. I will add the link to her TED Talk in the episode notes. Liz?
So my name's Liz White. I'm the leader of the Animal Protection Party of Canada. I started in the, became an animal rights activist and in the late 1980s or early 1990s. Was at the Toronto Humane Society, got fired from there for having perhaps too radical thoughts along with some of the other people there, which was quite funny, but it allowed us to form Animal Alliance. And then in 2005, the Supreme Court ruled that the Canada Elections Act needed to be amended to allow smaller parties to be able to actually form properly and participate in elections. And so in 2005, 2006, we formed the Animal Protection Party of Canada. And so we've been around for about 18 years, I guess. The barriers in the act for small parties mean that they will never really be able to participate in a way that the Party for the Animals does, for example, in the Netherlands, where they actually are able to elect people to all levels of government, including the European Parliament. So we're looking at legislative changes and to the Act. But of course, the Act is controlled by the large parties who have their own interests, which is not to add any political parties to the mix. And so it'll be an uphill battle, but we're looking at some of the avenues to actually break down some of those barriers.
Thank you, Liz. Irene?
Yes, I'm Irene Kaye. I'm in Burlington, Ontario, and I will be running as a candidate for the Animal Protection Party when the next federal election rolls around. I have two heroes. One is Gary Francione, who I discovered when I very first went vegan. And I loved his argument that basically if most people would agree that it's wrong to harm an animal unnecessarily, and that if you take that to its logical extension, because we don't need animals to live, we don't need to eat animals to live, then any killing of an animal is unnecessary. And his main argument, he's a legal scholar, and his main argument from a legal point of view is that as long as animals continue to be property, classed as property, then there's no, all the animal welfare laws in the world are not going to help them. And as it stands now, most of the animal welfare laws do not cover the vast majority of farmed animals that we raise and slaughter for food. My other hero is Will Tuttle, and his famous book is The World Peace Diet. Again, I read that 10 years ago when I first went vegan. I literally wept on every page, because he writes so poetically and so movingly about the plight of animals, especially the plight of the female animals, because it's basically animal husbandry is exploitation of the female, the female chicken, the female pig, the female cow, and the most abused animal on the planet is the dairy cow.
Thank you, Irene. Debbie, your turn.
Debbie Wall, and I ran for the Animal Protection Party of Canada in 2021. I became the first Manitoban to represent the party. And I had my aha moment in 1978 when I was attending pre-veterinary classes at the University of Manitoba. And we went to the annual Aggie Bash, and I happened to see a little calf. And when I went over to say hi to them, they licked my face, and I realized, you're no different than a dog. And another thing I realized is that we as humans are capable of doing all kinds of mental gymnastics to justify all kinds of horrible things that we do to animals. But once something touches your heart, there's just no denying it. So that was a big lesson for me. And in terms of, and I've been involved in animal rights, liberation, protection in various forms since then. And I have to say, my heroes are pretty much anybody who speaks up on behalf of the animals, because it's not an easy place to be swimming against what most of society is doing.
Thank you, Debbie. And finally, Edward.
Yeah, Edward Fraser. I'm running for the Animal Protection Party of Canada in High Park, Parkdale, in the upcoming election. I came to veganism and a bit of a strange way. I had been a vegetarian for many, many years, kind of justifying that as being good enough, and of course realized, of course, it's not. But I saw some advertising on the subway here in Toronto for the Fur Bears Association out of BC, and I naively thought to myself, well, they don't actually use fur anymore. That's barbaric. Did a bit of research and realized, yeah, there is still a somewhat what's called thriving fur industry. And of course, with Canada Goose and all of those other type of coats, that it had actually made quite of a comeback. So that was kind of my way of understanding that there needed a lot more to be done. So I transitioned to veganism at that point. And activism in support of animal rights causes grew from there. As come to realize that it's these sort of industries still exist. It's necessary work that groups like the Animal Protection Party of Canada and Animal Justice and so many other groups that are fighting for animal rights. And I'll just say that it's those people who do the work with those groups that are my heroes. You know, a lot of the people who are out there, like Earthling Ed, like Mike mentioned, and you know, bringing awareness to the cause, you know, I have to give respect to those people, but it's so many of the people who are doing the grassroots initiatives, you know, getting to know Mike a little bit virtually through the memes we've done with the party, the respect I have for somebody like him. It's so easy for me to do in my neighborhood where it's accepting. I see vegan stickers all over the place. I have access to all sorts of restaurants and resources. I have a community here. You know, Mike is swimming upstream, like Debbie said, in his area, and you know, to fight the fight in that those sort of conditions, all the respect in the world.
Thank you, Edward. So, Mike, you wanted to react to what Irene said.
Oh yeah, she was talking about Gary Francione. So I thought I'd add him to my list because I read his stuff and I like him too. And that reminds me, there's a couple of other good books I could recommend. Just because I'm gonna have to go in a few minutes, so there's one I really like. It's called Eternal Treblinka by Charles Patterson. I don't know if you guys have read or heard of this one, but he's a Jewish animal rights activist. So sort of like same idea as Alex Hirschhaft, and he wrote that book, and I found it really powerful. He like talks about the sources of discrimination and oppression and those mentalities, how they sort of infect or poison like everything in society. There's another good one I like. It's called there's a couple of books called Dominion, but this one is called like the Dominion Power of Man, and it's by this guy Matthew Scully. And this one is more directed for arguing for animal rights from a religious perspective. So that's I've always found, because I'm not religious at all, talking to religious people during street outreach is one of the more difficult sells. So trying to find common ground with them is kind of tough. But I've noticed that religious people tend to be more likely to stop and watch and want to have a conversation with you, like when you're doing a cube of truth. And so I figured trying to come up with some some good arguments to sort of meet them where they are. This book was good for me for that. So for anyone who wants to, who needs help, like to learn how to outreach with more religious people, specifically the Dominion is for the Christian people.
Thank you for the recommendations, Mike. Those are two great authors that I truly love. Since you have to go soon, Edward mentioned how this is an upstream battle for you. Tell me more about that. What's so difficult about talking about animal protection, animal rights in Newfoundland?
Yes, so the culture in Newfoundland is a little bit different than the rest of Canada. So Newfoundland used to be its own country until around World War II. Let me double check the exact year. I used to have this memorized. Yeah, 1949 is when Newfoundland joined Canada. Before then, they were their own country. So there's a lot of like nationalistic pride specifically for Newfoundland. Like we have a separatist party and everything. And the culture, so they're very proud of their culture, and specifically though being an island, it's very heavily based on like fishing and hunting and the seal hunts as well. So that's like a big part of most Newfoundlanders' identities, and they're always trying they're all obsessed with the fishery, trying to defend it. Like it's their, a lot of people, it's their whole identity. This exploiting and using animals, it's baked into the culture, and they're sensitive about it too. Like they feel like they're somehow persecuted by the rest of the world or misunderstood about like ignorant townie people, sort of. Anyway, the point is that you're considered, like for being a vegan here, you're almost considered a cultural traitor to Newfoundland culture. Like you're directly fighting against the most important things in Newfoundlanders' identity and their culture, to go against the fishery and the seal hunt specifically. It's just a ridiculous political issue, and that's all it is now. It's just, yeah, almost like the nonsense that you got going in the States, like where the Republicans and Democrats are like completely polarized and it's just random stuff. And you like you have to fall in line with one extreme or the other. I don't know. It's sort of like gun control or something. I don't know much about it, but I think Republicans are like the worst evil ever is to take their guns away from them. But I'm not sure exactly, but if it feels like that, like when we do seal hunt protests, it's just a lot more tense and the hostility is like way higher, even than if we do like a Cuba Truth racial slaughterhouse footage or do a vigil out in front of the Country Ribbon chicken death camp. It's like, even though we're opposing all of animal agriculture, which obviously would include the seal hunt, they're less incensed by that than when we do seal hunt protests directly, where you get people screaming at us and shouting or threatening violence, that kind of thing, or trying to call the cops and stuff. But yeah, so I guess it's like that. I feel the culture here is less progressive because the sort of a little bit isolationist, and because of their history with the seal hunt and the just hunting and fishing in general. So it's a very uphill battle here, more so than other places I've visited. Like I lived in Portugal for 5 years, and even though like a lot of Newfoundland culture is actually based on old Portuguese culture, because they were always sending the fishing boats over here, so they even have some similar dishes, like the jigs dinner we have here, which is traditionally they have like a dead piece of turkey or corpse, but a lot of vegetables like greens and turnips, and they have gravy and stuff that's based on a Portuguese dish. But even so, that it's like night and day with the animal rights community in Portugal is like so much bigger and so much better organized and tight knit there. And they have like a lot of good events and demos all across the country. And they're more accepted. They have a political party as well called PAN, Pessoas Animais Natureza. And they had recently won that, like, they have proportional representation as well over there. So they had a couple seats in parliament. And like the party leader for PAN was able to bring motions to ban bullfighting. And even though they didn't get passed, the bullfighting in Portugal, very, very similar to the seal hunt here in terms of culture and their like obsession with cultural identity and stuff. So, but he was able to bring that to parliament and make some really good arguments. Like, and we did bullfighting protests over there too, and there was a lot more people at the bullfight protest than there would ever be at a seal hunt protest here, even though it was like done outside of coliseums and they had people screaming at them and yelling and hostility. But they also had some supportive people. I don't know, like, you might imagine the southern United States culturally, like, they're very conservative there, and you would imagine that they're like pro hunting and very against animal rights, more than like more liberal parts of the States. So I feel it's like that, the version of that in Canada is Newfoundland.
I understand. That's better. Yes, thank you, Mike. Thank you. Interesting.
Yes, thanks.
Yes, very interesting. You know, I have lots of American listeners. And I wonder if we could talk about the state of, animal welfare in Canada. So maybe we could, you could maybe give a mark to Canada, like on 10, what would be Canada's great in terms of animal protection laws, and compared to other countries, maybe if you have experience living elsewhere, like, how would you describe Canada in terms of, animal welfare? And maybe we could start with Liz.
Probably not very high, between 1 and 10, 1 being bad and 10 being good. The biggest area is animal agriculture. And as we experience people going into various places and documenting the immense cruelty that happens in these places, in these private farms, which are usually the big large farms, and how little is done to rectify the situations in those places, and then being faced with ag-gag legislation so that there's big penalties if somebody does go into a farm and document, even if they document the extreme cruelty, even if the film shows, you know, the enormous, terrible cruelty that goes on with these animals. It's the people who get prosecuted and not the farmer. And so, you know, when you talk about volume, probably Canada isn't as bad as the United States because the farms aren't as large. I mean, some dairy farms in the States are 100,000 cows, whereas in Canada, you know, they're not that large. But, you know, I sat through a court case with where the Canadian Food Inspection Agency took Maple Lodge Farms to court over cruelty to the animals that were being delivered to the slaughterhouse. And so it was, you know, they kill almost 500,000 chickens a day. And some of those are spent hens. And some of them come from very long distances, including from the United States. And so you look at these situations and you think that Canada really on the animal agriculture side has not done a lot. However, I say under the Trudeau government, and I say this cautiously, they have passed legislation that would ban the use of animals in cosmetic testing, and the products that are tested from elsewhere are now banned in Canada. That's pretty low-hanging fruit. You know, I started working on that in 1990, and so, you know, it's taken until 2023 to get that legislation passed. But they have done other stuff. They've banned strychnine in Canada. They've banned, and they're in the process of looking at banning the trade in horses to Japan for live slaughter. So, you know, it isn't that things haven't happened. It's just that the volume of cruelty is so large that these small advances are appear to be really small. So, you know, we still have lake hole trapping. We still drown beavers with conibear traps and lake hole traps. We still use fur. We still do horse racing. We do all the various things. We use animals for our own purposes. And really that dynamic, which is what we're trying to change, has not changed a great deal yet, but it's a big fight.
Thank you, Liz. Debbie?
Just to kind of pick up a little bit where on what Liz said, yeah, there's this kind of real piecemeal approach to improving you know, the protection of animals in our country. Canada is actually notorious for having some of the poorest animal protection laws in the developed world. And one of the issues is we have this whole big long list of what are called accepted activities. And it's pretty much every possible use of animals that you can imagine that are exempt from our protection laws as long as standard codes of practice are followed. So this is why you can euthanize, big quotation marks around euthanize, baby pigs by taking them by their hind legs and slamming their head into the concrete. But if you did the same thing to a puppy or a kitten, you would be charged with cruelty to animals. And it makes no sense. Like, our laws should be based on science and not emotion. So it makes no sense that only the animals that we are emotionally attached to, that is our companion animals, get a modicum of protection. Meanwhile, science tells us that all animals are equally capable of suffering. So I think we would make a huge step forward if we got rid of those accepted activities, and animals under the law are considered right now just to be property, and there's a big push for the government to at least recognize them as sentient beings.
Thank you, Debbie. Edward, so what grade would you give Canada?
Yeah, I'm a bit more of a pessimist. I'd give it a, is it, can you give an F minus? Is that possible? But I mean, I don't think Canada is alone in that. I mean, I would think every country around the world gets a failing grade. But what gives me hope is individuals and the fight, and that you can make a small difference as an individual or a small group. Yeah, wide scale change is the goal. But by not eating meat for one meal, you're making a difference. You're helping to save an animal's life. So while I haven't seen in my 20 years of being kind of aware of these issues, haven't seen a lot of political movement, some tokenism stuff, as Liz spoke about, sure. But yeah, I mean, that's why the critical areas, and this is why I was motivated to get involved with the political party. That's where change is going to be affected, is at the political level and at the legal level. And so if we can win court cases to change laws, that's when people's opinions are going to change. And when people's widespread opinion change, that's when political gains are made. So we're a ways off, but that's why grassroots movement, grassroots activism, and individual actions still matter. It's such a huge, huge issue, and there's so much room to go. It can feel overwhelming. But every individual action, even if you're not a vegan, if you choose to go meatless for a week, if you choose to buy a faux leather jacket instead of a leather jacket, all these small actions by many, many individuals add up to a big thing.
Thank you, Edward. Irene?
As far as giving Canada a grade, I agree. We're way down the list. But the thing is that all around the world, going back to what Debbie was talking about when her encounter with the calf, is that if you were born a dog in North America, your prospects are way different than if you were a dog born in South Korea or China. Because there, dogs are eaten. So all around the world, we use animal, every culture uses animals from nose to tail, in all different and horrible ways. But one, I came across, one of my interests is transitioning factory farms to other uses. And I came across something the other day that's happening in the States. It's been put forth by Cory Booker, of course, who's a vegan, and also James McGovern, and it's called the Industrial Agriculture Conversion Act in the U.S. And looking for federal support for converting farms from animal agriculture. And that I would love to see. It's called transfarming, and you've probably heard the term, but it's really taken my interest because it's the same as in the fossil fuel industry. There's this big hoo-ha, oh my God, all the oil workers are going to lose their jobs. Well, they don't necessarily have to. They may lose that job, but hey, they can get another job in a green industry. Now, whether they want to or not, I don't know. But again, looking back historically, when the internal combustion engine came along, what happened to all the buggy whip makers? What about all the horseshoe, the blacksmith who did the horseshoes? Well, hey, guess what? They found something else to do. So that's something that I'm really looking forward to, taking these farm buildings that are already there, taking these farmers who are up to their eyeballs in debt and beholden to the big chicken producers, and enabling them to transition out of that and make use of their land and their buildings to the to more green and more healthy options. So, thanks.
Thank you, Irene. And I should say on a positive note that South Korea has passed a law to ban the slaughter and trade of dog meat, but the ban will only take effect in 2027. Liz, you wanted to react to Edward's point.
I was just going to say that I think Edward made a really good point. But I was going to say the thing that we need to do is to move Canada into a proportional representation voting system. The current system will not allow us to elect anybody to Parliament unless it's some like outlier somewhere that happened just to, you know, be in the right place at the right time. It's just not possible. Everything in the Canada Elections Act is stacked against us getting elected. And so when you look at places like the Netherlands, which has probably the largest vegan animal rights party for the animals, with representation throughout government levels, that they have been able to pass much more progressive legislation and have even greater discussions about what changes need to be made. And in fact, there's, you know, a revolt by the dairy farmers there because there's discussion about beginning to wrap up dairy farming practices. And so, you know, we would not be able to, we would barely be able to have that discussion here. So I think we've been involved with the Springtide and Fair Voting BC, who are now in the appeals court, trying to get proportional representation. They'll be going to the Supreme Court, and we intend to intervene there to see if we can actually get the Supreme Court to consider change. It's a big, big if, but I think it's really a worthwhile fight. And if even we get some better practices, we might be able to make greater progress. I mean, you know, our wonderful candidates who run know that they're doing outreach and talking to people, which I do as well when I run as a candidate, but knowing that they aren't going to get elected. And, you know, it takes a real strong, committed person to take on that role and go out and talk to people and you know, knowing that, you know, you're probably going to be bottom of the list when, you know, all of the politics that we talk about not only affects all the animals, but affects us because of the contribution to the greenhouse gases, which animal agriculture is huge.
And quickly, Liz, for those who don't know, what is proportional representation?
It means that people who vote, every vote is counted. So it depends on the type of proportional representation. In Canada, we've talked about the single transferable vote, which is one way, and the other is we've talked about mixed member proportional. Both of those are much more inclusive of actually calculating how people vote and then how they're allocated to the final outcome of the election. And the provinces who have looked at proportional representation, I think British Columbia has been through it twice, Ontario at least once, have set the bar so high. You know, it wasn't a 50 plus one vote. It was 60%. And the vote, the latest vote in BC, I think was about 58 or 59%. So it was very, very close, but they were unable to make the higher levels. So so I think, you know, the challenge is when politicians are in Parliament, they don't want to give it up. When they're out of Parliament, they talk about proportional representation, as did Trudeau and other politicians. And when they're in, they think, maybe not. I want to hold on to my seat. I don't want to share it.
Yes, it was a promise of the Trudeau first electoral campaign, and I did vote for him because of that. I remember that very clearly. Edward, you wanted to add something?
For those who are interested in getting a little more information on farming transition, there was a really easily digestible news item on the NBC News report, actually in the US, about a farmer who is using a grant for Mercy for Animals to change from a livestock farm to an organic vegetable farm, and how amazing that's been for him, and how that can be accomplished. So I'd encourage people to look that up, because it shows what impact that can have on individual farmers, and how that is a viable option for people who might be involved in the livestock industry now and hoping to get out of it.
Thank you, Edward. Debbie?
I just wanted to add, if anybody's really interested in learning more about proportional representation, I would recommend going to Fair Vote Canada. And you can do a real deep dive there and get involved with the movement to achieve proportional representation in the country.
Thank you, Debbie. I will add the link to Fair Vote Canada in the episode's notes. Liz?
Just two quick things. First, I'm happy to share the links with the Fair Voting BC and Springtide. They do regular reports about what money they're raising, how the court cases went, what the issues are that were being discussed, all that sort of stuff. So Rayanne, I'll send it to you and maybe you can add it in. And the second thing is, we have in Canada, in Ontario, in Quebec, I think, a farmer who's promoting vegan farming. And he's written a book. He's run a workshop just recently. And he's amazing because he has incorporated the entire environment around his farm into the production of vegetables, which is what he does is veganic, but he doesn't use any animal fertilizer. He doesn't. So it's all minimally tilled. It's a really interesting thing. So I'll send you a link to his website, and that's where the vegan farming issue began, was in the Netherlands, around all that progressive thinking with Party for the Animals and others there.
Thank you, Liz. I did not know about this farmer in the same province where I'm based. I would love to visit his farm this coming summer. Okay, so since we are on the topic of politics, let's talk about politics. Liz, this is your second time on the podcast, and the first episode we recorded together was very impactful to me. You know, it really made me rethink, you know, animal rights activism and what it should look like, and the importance of politics in all of that, in that equation. So all of you, I'm under the presumption that all of you agree with that, that politics are a priority in advancing the cause of animal protection. So I guess I would like to hear your best argument for getting more involved in politics, in, every, I guess, level of government, as an animal rights activist, as a vegan. So who would like to start? Irene, maybe?
Well, I confess I am a novice in the political arena. I guess I was on a call the other day, and the speaker was talking about sort of from the highest levels of government down to the down from the federal, provincial, local, municipal, and basically his argument was that especially on the at the higher levels, and I know Liz can speak to this much more eloquently than I can, but that at the higher levels, even say this bill that in the States that Cory Booker's sponsoring, they're going to run into all kinds of stonewalling, and they're actually, kill committees where their job is to kill the bill, delay the bill, filibuster, so all of these things happen at the higher levels. And this speaker was saying that where he works at a state level, he has forged relationships with politicians on the lower levels. And his argument was, even if you don't agree with what the person, you know, like they may be a hunter, but they may not agree with trophy hunting. They may be a meat eater, but they love cats and dogs. And so if you can find any type of relationship with these individuals without alienating them, then you have a basis with which to move forward with your agenda. And so I'm taking that, like, again, where I live, there's a huge meat packing plant, meat slaughterhouse. 10,000 pigs a day are killed in Burlington. And yet I feel powerless. I don't know that I can actually stop this legitimate enterprise from, it's free country. They're a profit-making organization. They provide jobs in the community. But the only way that I could possibly do anything with that would be if the city of Burlington makes some sort of law that outlaws that type of activity. So, as I say, I'm not really terribly versed on the subject, but I'm passionate. So I'll let others speak.
No, you're bringing some very pertinent points. I love, love, love that approach. I think we tend to antagonize and make, you know, an enemy out of hunters, out of farmers, out of, you know, the list goes on. Instead of looking at, like you said, you know, ways of creating, building relationships with those actors, with those people. Edward, you wanted to react.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. I've always taken an approach of killing with kindness. Of course, people can't see my quote marks on this audio podcast. But, you know, when you can reach people on a level and make them understand that, because for a standard person who, as my wife and I have often said it when we were where we were pre-veganism, was plugged into the matrix, it's hard to get out of that because our entire society is built on animal agriculture. But if you can make people realize that even a small difference can have a huge impact, they're more willing to make that. And then if you take that first step, making the second and third and fourth and fifth step is much, much easier. To answer your question about politics, you don't need to be a politician. And I would, of course, be reticent to call myself a politician, even though I'll be running in an election. You can just be a professional pain in the ass. You know, that's where I was at before aligning with the party. I would constantly be pestering my municipal and provincial and federal representatives to try to make change. To what effect, you know, debatable, even getting a response is sometimes difficult. But especially at the municipal level, you know, I have a slaughterhouse that I unfortunately often smell at the stockyards, which is just on the border here of the High Park, Parkdale riding. You know, and to me, you know, I'm not going to be able to win that war probably on an animal rights or compassion basis, but the smell that it produces. I've talked to lots of people who are carnivores who say, "What is that smell?" And I'm always happy to let them know exactly what it is. And, you know, I think, you know, the vast majority of people would be in favor of shutting that down, or at least in their mind, moving it so that it wasn't, you know, a little NIMBYism. Maybe I don't mind it if it happens because I still want my hamburger, but I don't want to smell it. Well, if I can shut that down based on that, I don't care how it gets done. So taking alternative approaches to finding ways to get policy change on the municipal level can be an effective way. You know, you have to try to reach people on their level, and you can't get people to go from 0 to 10 overnight. That's not going to happen for most people. If you can get people to just, you know, make small changes, I've always found that to be a much more effective way to get people to change.
Yes, I absolutely agree, Edward. And even, you know, if you vote for a measure for that slaughterhouse to, you know, stop emitting that smell, and because of that measure, they need to renovate the building, we're talking about extra costs that, you know, eat away from that margin of profit that this industry makes. So, sure, that's also a victory. Debbie?
There's often a discussion as to where we should be focusing on individual change versus systemic change, and I think we need both. And running for the party, to me, is a way of working on systemic change. Like, I've been a member of the Animal Alliance for forever, and a member of the Animal Protection Party of Canada since its inception. Liz had gone on a cross-country tour. This was pre-pandemic, trying to recruit new candidates. And at the time, I thought, you know, there's no way I have the time or the resources to actually run. But then I learned about being a paper candidate, which essentially just getting your name on the ballot. And I thought, you know, I can do that. So I got my name on the ballot. But what it ended up going into was a paper candidate plus, because once I got on the ballot, I had people reach out to me to take part in some debates. I was part of a student forum. One of the high schools in my riding, they had asked all parties to bring a lawn sign there, and they had the students research the party. So I was able to reach a whole lot more people in a way I have never done so before by being a paper candidate. And when the dust all settled after the election, I was last in my riding in terms of votes. But in the student election, I was third from last. So it was very, to me, that was a very interesting a lesson that it's going to be the young folks who have more on the line in terms of things, climate change, that are going to take more interest and hopefully move the needle forward for the animals here in Canada.
Thank you, Debbie. Liz?
I think in Canada, we do very little education about politics. We don't really talk about how politics works in Canada, what's different between the federal level, the provincial level, and the municipal level. Why are all three there? You know, we're now having a discussion in Ontario about interference by the provincial government into municipal politics. When we elect people at the city level, the provincial level is telling our politicians in the city level how to run the city. And so I think our party offers an opportunity for younger people who are, I guess, finding it difficult to look at the situation and wonder why change can't happen. People, you know, write to me all the time and say, I wrote to my politician about this, that, or other issue, and nothing has happened. Because I think people think that you can, that they can simply write a letter or click on a petition or do whatever, and the issue will be dealt with. So very few people that I know have actually met with their politicians, have actually sat down and had a conversation with them. And you can agree to disagree with the person, but you can have a perfectly friendly talk. And I think, you know, it, our party provides people with the opportunity to actually do that and to actually begin to navigate the political system that we have, because it's very complicated. And it takes a long time to learn actually how to do that, to actually permeate the political parties on Parliament Hill. It's, you know, it's like storming the barracks. You can't, you know, it's very, very hard to get in to talk to people. So, and most people are lovely and reasonable and want to hear you and maybe even want to help you. But if you can't get to talk to them personally, it makes it very, very difficult. So the last point politically, We had to deal with the cosmetic issue, ban on cosmetic animal testing, which is actually done federally because of the testing and the cosmetics. So we were managed to put together a coalition of people, including the industry. And those were animal rights people. Those were people who produced animal rights products, Lush and the Body Shop. And then we had a very sympathetic minister, the Honorable Jean-Yves Duclos, who allowed us access to it and participated in the whole process. And so it got done. But, you know, it took 30 years to do it. So it just happened that those all aligned that made it possible.
You have been a few now mentioning, you know, younger people. And Liz, you also mentioned actions that people take online. And there was something I realized from looking at the Animal Protection Party. You know, I looked at your social media. There are thousands of people, you know, following you, engaging with you on social media platforms. Yet, you know, relatively to that following, there are very few, a few number of candidates, you know. So I wonder why, you know, why are those people captured by social media and not able to, you know, engage in a true meaningful way with the nonprofit they support in theory?
Are you asking me?
Sure. I mean, and yeah. Anyone.
I don't want to occupy the conversation, but
no, go ahead.
I think there are several reasons why. First of all, I think younger people are much busier than maybe some of us, some of us have retired, some of us are, you know. I think it's because they're busy. They have to make enough money to support if they have a family and all that sort of stuff. Secondly, I think the barrier is, which is what I talked about, is that most people don't understand that in order to make real change for animals, we have to talk to the politicians. They're the ones that make the decision about who dies, who lives, who is used in research, how they're used, what kind of extreme cruelty can be applied to them and what is considered an acceptable way by society. Most people don't know what is actually happening. So although they support an organization that does it, they may not want to be specifically involved. And that's why I look to like PAN we were talking about and Party for the Animals, because they have been able to garner a much younger group of people to actually run politically. And I think we still have an uphill battle to make that change. It makes it much more difficult to attract people. I'm very, very, very glad that people are part of the organization, are supporting us in many ways, including in donations. You know, they may not have decided that it's something they feel like they could really do. I would encourage them to do it because in the end, it can be lots of fun. I talk to all kinds of people. We have great arguments, you know, very friendly or agreements or whatever. And we get to talk about all kinds of things. We get to debate in front of all candidates' meetings. We get to talk to a huge crowd. I went to one in Thornhill. The number of people there were about 350. I was the only oddball there because I talked about things that nobody else really want to talk about. But anyway, a bunch of people in the crowd came up and said that they really enjoyed it and that they would give it some thought. So you realize that the outreach is very, very different. But I think, you know, the learning curve in terms of how politics works in this country is something that we really need to work on, particularly with younger people, so they realize the importance of running.
Thank you, Liz. Edward?
I mean, I think we could probably do an entire show or maybe even a 12-part series on youth and politics. But I think it comes down to a couple of things. I think when you're younger, you don't realize the true path towards change will come through political and legal roads. If you're passionate about something, because there's an instant gratification that comes through protesting, things like vigils, things like that. That you don't get that from the political realm. But as you get older, maybe you get a little bit wiser, that you come to realize these things. At least that's the way it was for me, and I suspect that is the way it is for a lot of people. But I would say to anybody who's listening, it can definitely seem intimidating, and I think in our current political climate, it's also very easily to get disillusioned by the process and to think it doesn't matter. But for me, just knowing that there was somebody out there who shared my vision, who shared my hopes, buoyed my spirits. And I think that people can appear even as a paper candidate for the party. So if you're passionate about animal rights, just be on the ballot, because just seeing that name on the ballot makes a huge difference. It makes people realize that there are others out there who share those same views. And even if it gets one or two or three people to think, wow, what is this? I want to look into it more. It makes a big difference, because I know for me, I just, when I was voting in the last election, it was provincial election, but I got thinking, well, there must be a party out there. And that's what led me to find this road. And, I wasn't expecting much, but when I dug in and looked at the party platform, I was blown away by how well presented it is, by how thoroughly thought out it is, how well worded it is. And so if you can get others just to make those connections by seeing a name on the ballot, to doing a bit of research, to reading more, to getting more, it really does, all those small steps can really build to something big. So I would encourage anybody who might be interested, look into it a little bit, and if you're interested, just appear as a paper candidate, because it really can, with not a whole lot of effort, make a very big difference.
Yes, the unexpected consequences of just, putting your name out there. And, I also loved what Debbie was saying about how this promoted the cause, and she got invitation to various, places like schools. Irene?
Yes, this is a little bit of an outlier comment, but one of the stand-up comedians on the late-night talk show was talking about the U.S. Thanksgiving coming up, and he said, "Oh yes, and you'll gather with the family and that one person who suddenly went vegan, made that kind of comment, that ridicule comment about veganism," and I'm brought to mind about that quote that was attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, but apparently it isn't actually his quote. But first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. And that's in terms of excuse me, what Liz was talking about, that this cosmetic change was like 30 years in the making. But yeah, first they laugh at you, then they ridicule you, then they attack you, and guess what? Then you make progress. So this is a long game, and unfortunately, these things do take time. But what else are we going to do? And I think that's the sentiment shared by most of the people who are in this movement, is if we do nothing, then the animals will continue to suffer. We have to do what we can at whatever level we can to make life better for the whole world, but especially for the animals.
Yes, using, business vocabulary, we're investing it into a future. into, you know, future profit, and that profit is a world without animal exploitation. Liz?
Well, I guess the last thing that I think I would say on this issue is that we have actually a pretty big community who are out there doing all sorts of different things, promoting the idea of veganism and animal, eliminating animals from our culture of exploitation. So we need to find a way to incorporate all the actions of all those people into the political party. And I say that by way of, for example, the people who are out bearing witness to the pigs at Fearman's and to the cows, the cull dairy cows at St. Helens near Edward, that they collect data for us. They can show what do the cows actually look like in the truck? How are the pigs actually doing in a temperature of 85 degrees in a metal can with a bunch of pigs there? How is all that happening? We can use that information collectively to put into the party hopper and begin to approach government about those issues, which we've now started to do. There's people who are collecting the condition of the cows that are going into Helens, which are pretty terrible, with the CFIA and with the federal government. So we'll see if we can make some progress on that. But we have a big community, and we need to find a way to connect everybody so that we work together on all of these issues. And that way we'll begin to magnify the kinds of things that we're talking about, politically speaking.
Yes, great point. Which also brings me to the topic of the constituents, you know, the people who are going to vote for the party and for this cause. Do we have an idea of the profile of those people? Do vegans, you know, are vegans active in politics? Should they be more, you know, are they the ones, you know, who go and vote? Are they the ones who will be behind you, supporting you?
I think that the problem is that the vegan community is very small in comparison to the entire population. So it's very difficult to actually specifically identify how many vegans live in, say, the riding that I ran in. I know that there are people there, but I wouldn't know how many. I wouldn't know where they are necessarily. So I think what we need to do is look at the whole riding. This is what we've done before, to evaluate how to move votes. What you want to do is evaluate ridings where the votes are swing. So this is a riding that doesn't necessarily vote liberal all the time or conservative all the time. And they switch back and forth and the margins are narrow. And so we've done a number of studies in communities where that happens. And what you find, if you're able to measure it, which is really important to do, is that you can actually move votes from one party to another, and you can make the argument to move to the Animal Protection Party of Canada, if not for as a reason of being vegan, but for saving the planet for your kids or whatever the argument is. So we really need to understand how to move these votes and how to actually appeal to those people in the riding who are prepared to change their vote between elections during elections. So I think it's very difficult to actually figure out the vegan aspect of it. I know there are ridings like Parkdale and that have a lot of vegan residents. And there are some in my riding, but most people don't know how many there are and where they live and whether they vote, how old they are, what their, you know, economic income is, or their whatever profile you might have on them are. They don't know anything really about them. And so I think it's very difficult to target because just specifically on that.
Thank you, Liz. Debbie?
I would encourage anybody listening to the podcast to please go to the Animal Protection Party of Canada's website and see that it's not just strictly engaged in vegan topics. You know, we have positions on things like education, for example. So it's not just that narrow sort of focus. And it's estimated that perhaps like 3% of the population is vegan. But I think we also appeal to those who are very much about the environment. You know, if you hear anything about the climate catastrophe, the entire focus is on fossil fuels. And nobody is really discussing the negative impacts of animal agriculture. And that goes far, far beyond just the amount of greenhouse gases that it contributes. It's like environmental degradation, habitat and species loss, fresh water waste and pollution, ocean acidification, dead zones. It's leading to antibiotic resistance. It's checking off all the boxes for conditions that will lead to the next pandemic. And it's got like huge negative human health impacts. In 2019, Canada created the current Canada Food Guide, which was produced by 37 scientists out of 3 years of research and industry influence. And it shows that the diet that's optimum for our human health is one that's dominantly whole plant foods. Probably a lot of people would be surprised to know that billions of dollars continue to subsidize animal agriculture. And we need to shift those subsidies and make those foods that keep us healthy, those whole plant foods, affordable and available to all. So, which would result in drastically reduced healthcare costs. So there's all these other issues that come into play that people care about. So it's not just like an animal rights issue. There's all these other factors that come in. This is very much an integrated kind of system. And we need some big changes if we want to keep this planet healthy for everyone. People, I think, are attracted by that as well.
Yes, really good point. Edward?
I think as politics becomes more and more polarizing, I hope people will start to look to alternatives. And I think that those alternatives will hopefully manifest in proportional representation, because as we've all learned at all political levels, minority governments are where actual change that the people want get made. And proportional representation is like that on steroids. It's where every voice is heard. And that's why, you know, this party has invested so heavily in trying to affect that change, is because really that's where the will of the people will be manifested. And even in small groups. And it's not just people who are interested in specifically this topic. It's people who are passionate about any number of things. Should get fully behind proportional representation, because in the current system, first past the post, one group is going to, for the vast majority of the time, is going to hold all the power, and a majority of the people within the population is not going to have their voices heard. Whereas in proportional representation, everybody gets a piece of the pie. So that, to me, is where not only for veganism and for animal rights, but for all causes, you know, that's where you're going to see the real political change. So it is unfortunate that, as we've discussed, the people in power, of course, are the ones who make the decision at the time, and they never want to change because they want to stay in power. But I think, I say I think when I really mean hope. I hope that one day the people will eventually reach that critical line where they decide, no, we need to have our voices heard, and we need to have all our voices heard. And the best way to do that is through proportional representation.
Yes, not just the politicians, the constituents too. I remember when, I think in his second electoral campaign, when Trudeau was against the conservative, projections showed that if we had a proportional representation, he would have lost. And many, you know, liberals I know were happy, actually, that he did not implement those reforms, those democratic reforms, because that would have meant, you know, a victory for the Conservative Party. Debbie?
Well, I just wanted to add that the Green Party is probably the most readily recognized as having the strongest position on the environment, but even they are not calling for a major transition in our food system. So it has been joked that the Animal Protection Party of Canada is greener than the Greens.
It's very true, very true. The reason why I bring the topic of constituents is partly because, you know, in light of the recent Republican victory in the U.S., I have realized that, and let me know what you think, but that the animal rights movement has not done a good job at gaining constituents, like allies, among conservatives. And, you know, I was thinking about what Mike said in the beginning of the podcast. He talked about how conservative people were in Newfoundland. He also mentioned Matthew Scully, who is this, you know, very mainstream conservative. He was a speechwriter for many Republican presidents, and he's also an animal rights advocate, a vegan, and who has written extensively on the conservative argument for veganism. And I feel like maybe we're missing on a whole, you know, pool of army of possible allies. And so what do you think? Do you think that we could be doing a better job at appealing to a more conservative audience? Who wants to take that? Debbie?
I think we have to think about where these conservative folks are getting their information from, and it's certainly not from wonderful podcasts like yourself. And mainstream media is just not carrying this message. They are being funded by, you know, people who are paying for the ads, which tends to be animal use and abuse industries. And we have much less resources to be able to counter that. We have, you know, for example, here in Winnipeg, it can be very hard to get any kind of space on buses. If you manage to get any space on the buses, they really want to dilute the message. So we have an uphill battle in terms of just getting the message out there to people who aren't hearing it.
Thank you, Debbie. Liz?
My message to everybody is we have no permanent friends and no permanent enemies in politics. So it very much depends on each situation. We've had, when I first got in going to Ottawa, I was put on a committee by the then agriculture minister to look at the issue of the import of puppies from the United States into Canada. And at that time, there were about 20,000 coming in. This is way back in the early 1990s. The minister was Bill McKnight. He was, by all accounts, a pretty hardcore conservative, but he loved dogs. And we sat on that committee with all of the importers and the people who were selling them and all that sort of stuff. Nobody wanted any changes. And, you know, I was the one person on the committee that was talking about an alternative. And he got so frustrated that he simply signed a directive to the border authorities that they were not to import any puppies that were genetically compromised, or where there was an infection, the entire truck would have to be turned back. Now, that had serious implications for the dogs on the trucks, the puppies. So we had to approach people at the border to see if we could get them properly handled. But it meant that the number of dogs coming across the border was dropped from 20,000 down to under 7,000 just in that one activity. So there are allies in every party. The question is, we don't have the same kind of resources as the agricultural community, and they affect many more ridings, so it makes it much more difficult. But occasionally, if you don't fight with them, I'm trying very hard not to fight with some of the conservatives because I disagree with some of their other policies. But nonetheless, we have to talk to them. If Pierre Poilievre gets elected, we have to go through that party and find out who we can talk to. Who is it that we can get in and see? Who is it that we can actually ask to do even a private member's bill to get it discussed in the legislature? So I think we just don't make enemies, and we probably don't have a lot of friends, but we need all of those capacities to actually make change.
Yes, I completely agree. And, you know, more than the in the higher level of, you know, politicians, even the constituents, you know, those politicians are elected by people. And if we show that those people care about animals, they will, you know, be more inclined to listen to us. Edward?
I think you make a really interesting point about the opportunities that are there to be to make gains within the conservative side, because, you know, the people who are religious do tend to have conservative leanings. So there are opportunities there that can be reached. But I think one thing that we often lose sight of as people in the animal rights community is that we can make gains in our interests when we try to support other issues that might not be germane to this specific topic. So what I mean by that is that we're probably all privileged in our lives in that we're not fighting day to day to keep ourselves and our families afloat. Because when that's the case, as it is with a lot of people, and that number is growing because of the wage divide, you don't have a lot of time to fight for others because you're fighting for yourself. So when we prop up people, whether that be through universal basic income, other measures to make sure that people aren't scraping by, they have more time for things that they're passionate about. Because I think a lot of people, you know, if they have their eyes open to what's going on, they're probably going to be more motivated to either take action or at least take steps. But when you can go to the grocery store and you can buy subsidized meat for cheaper than you can fresh vegetables, what are you going to buy when you're just trying to keep your family alive? So things that aren't specific to our cause, they're still within what we should be fighting for because they eventually lead to what will help our cause. And I think that sometimes that gets lost because, again, it feels so mountainous what we're climbing, what we're trying to achieve, but small gains in other ways can have big impacts on what we're trying to do.
Thank you, Edward. Makes me think, you know, off recording, I mentioned how I work in the fundraising philanthropic world, and, you know, a donation is classified as a luxury expense, actually. So when you donate to an organization, you're actually, you know, it's a luxury. It's considered a luxury, which I find interesting, and which, you know, echoes your point. Irene, we haven't listened to you answer for a moment now. Did you want to add something to this whole conversation?
Well, as I said before, I'm a bit of a novice at this, so I can't speak so knowledgeably, but I am so much in favor of allyship, you know, that this is the way we're going to get things done. Just a word about, I know we're talking about politics, but one of the, when you asked at the very beginning about who are our heroes and how do we get into this whole movement? I have changed my my outlook from the Gary Francione abolitionist stand, which is we have to end all animal use 100% across around the world. But unfortunately, that's just not going to happen. And so my position now is, I think, what we're calling pragmatic veganism. And that is, if you take 100 people and 10 of them go completely vegan overnight, no animal use whatsoever, and the other 90 people take a more flexitarian approach, they do meatless Mondays, they eat, they reduce their animal impact, the use of animals, who's going to make the most difference to the animals? Well, it's going to be the 90 people, not the 10. And we, you know, talk of luxury. We're the luxurious ones. We're the vegans who are happily vegan, and we don't have any type of mental conflict over it. The other 90, let them work through it. But they are our allies. They're not our opposition. They are our allies, and we need to encourage them in every way, including political. I was at the Burlington Veg Fest for the last several years, and Liz has been kind enough to sponsor me there, a booth. And I can't tell you the number of people who come up to the table and say, I didn't know there was a party. Wow, tell me more. And of course, I hand out the booklet, and I talk them up, and I ask, you know, get on the mailing list. And but again, how does that translate into actually going into the voting booth and voting? And again, I think that happened in the States. Everybody was expecting, especially I as a feminist, was expecting all the young women to turn out. They didn't turn out. And that was a great loss for the U.S. and for the world. So anyway, sort of a rambling comment there.
Thank you, Irene. Yes, Edward?
I just think that's so well said by Irene about allyship and being able to make difference through outreach. And, you know, I see it firsthand. You know, I was out recently with a group of friends, and you know, we were at a restaurant, not a vegan restaurant, just a regular restaurant. And one of the guys came in and he said, "Well, I guess I'm having the veggie burger." And I said, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Well, I was on the subway and I saw a Why Eat One and Love Another poster where you've got the pig juxtaposed against the puppy." And he said, "Well, I can't eat a burger now. You know, I got to have a veggie burger." So it shows that it works. You know, those things all work, and all those small measures add up to big things, because that was one less animal on a plate that night. So, you know, it sounds cliche, but when I got into this, I thought to myself, if I can change just one person's mind, or even change just one meal, then all I've had to made a difference. And if you think, if we can get people all across the country signing up to the party, one in each riding, eventually, fingers crossed, the goal, the amount of difference all those small actions will make, you know, it's really heartwarming to think of what that could eventually be.
Thank you, Edward. And that makes me think, I want to give a shout out to On Behalf of Animals. It's another podcast hosted by some very good friends. And in one episode, you know, they interviewed the lobbyist, and he said, an animal rights lobbyist, and he said, you need to meet those politicians and constituents with confidence, because our cause is a righteous cause. And I do feel that at my core, you know. So yeah, Mike, you're back. Welcome back. Just in time.
Yes, hello.
Just in time for, you know, wrapping this up. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much for all of your, you know, insights, for sharing your experience. Anything? Did you want to add anything before we end this recording? Last chance. Yes, Debbie.
I'd like to thank you for your interest in the party and inviting us onto your podcast. And the last word I want to leave for all your listeners is a quote by a wonderful activist, Regan Russell, who was killed by a transport truck carrying pigs at a vigil. And she said, doing nothing does no good. So I encourage everybody to do what they can. No action for the animals is too small or too big. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Mike?
Yes. So I was thinking of one more activist I'd like to include. So there was a Buddhist monk and philosopher named Thich Nhat Hanh, who died a couple of years ago. And as far as like a philosophy goes, I would say I'm closest. Like I like Buddhist ideas, so he was one of my favorites. Like I use a lot of quotes from him as well. I do outreach. Yeah, and they've made a film about his life. I think it's called Walk With Me. I would recommend that as well. It's about mindfulness and stuff. But yeah, it's a very nice philosophy that resonates with me. And of course, he was a vegan as well, and that was part of his like nonviolence philosophy.
Thank you, Mike. As a Buddhist, I truly appreciate this comment. Yes, Irene?
I just wanted to give this quote from another. It was part of a talk that I was involved in, and this basically says, although non-human animals should have some rights, the term rights can be emotive and negative, turning off listeners before you are even able to make your point. Think about gun rights, reproductive rights, civil rights. These terms can resonate or repulse depending on your audience. You cannot get your point across if nobody's listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Irene, for this. Again, thank you so much, everyone. And I truly wish that, you know, success and lots of votes for this upcoming election. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.